You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Everybody, welcome to the Paranormal Portal podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful night, and thank you so much for tuning in and supporting all that we're doing here on the podcast. It's been amazing. You guys have been amazing out there checking us out and subscribing and downloading, and it's just a real pleasure. Of course, I'm your host, Brent Thomas. This is the Paranormal Portal podcast, and
these are just encounters. They're not they're not firsthand accounts or written for sensationalism, and it just tells what happened. So it says, Charles Jackson and his son Kevin got the shock of their lives on an afternoon of July 12th, 1969. They were at their home in Cherokee Road in Oroville, well, southeast of Bluff Creek, which is also the sighting of the Patterson film, Patterson-Gimlin film, Bluff Creek, but not very far from the Plumas National Forest. Father and son were working peacefully in their backyard, burning rabbit entrails, which I guess is a good bonding thing. I don't know. When a huge ape-like creature loped out of the woods and stopped to stare at them. The beast was seen 7 to 8 feet tall and had large breasts and was covered in 3-inch long gray hair, except on its hands and face. The Jacksons, only 15 feet away at the time, said that after it spotted them, it walked up to the outhouse, looked around, and suddenly ran back in the woods. Another Cherokee Road resident had run in with an ape man around the same time as the Jackson incident. For weeks, Homer Stickley's farm had been haunted by something that screamed in the woods at night and stole apples from his trees. One moonlit night, Stickley saw the culprit, a tall, hirsute, two-legged creature that walked through a nearby meadow, pausing to stand by a stump. By September, at least a dozen people had reported giant ape-like things running around Oroville, but the Cherokee Road sightings remained the most documented and credible of the lot. 6 years later, people were still seeing the beasts and finding their huge footprints in the area. But the creature remained at large. By then, Oroville had established itself as another home of North America's most famous land monster, the Bigfoot. And so there you have it. I mean, and the funny thing about the accounts like that is, and this happens a lot in Bigfoot sightings, is we think of them as these, you know, really intelligent things that, you know, that, and maybe they are, and I'm not saying that they're not, but we think of them as you know, always aware of their surroundings and stuff. But this just seems like an oh no kind of moment. Like, just loped out of the woods and was like, oh. So I think they're maybe more human than we thought.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you know, nobody's perfect, and we can't, you know, expect Bigfoot to be either.
Right.
He's got to have the special kids.
But the funny thing is about this, and this is what's curious to me,
is that these are apparently pretty skittish beings, that they avoid us and they very actively avoid people. But sometimes it's just like, I don't know, I don't care, I'm walking through here, you know, and they don't run. They just are observed, kind of just walking, looking over their shoulder moseying. And checking things out. Yeah, moseying. It's like they're not stressed. They're not no anxiety. They're just like owning it.
Right. Yeah, if you're going to do it, you might as well own it. Yep.
Well, you know what I mean, though? And that's what I find really curious is what is happening, you know, that they're not worried. And then if they're so carefree, why don't we see them more often, you know? So that's kind of a conundrum in my head, I guess, in considering these things. But that's the first one. And I think it was a good one. I liked it. I like that one. Don?
Yes, it was good.
You enjoyed it? Good?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, here's one that goes all the way back to 1948. And this is kind of cool. And the reason why is because a lot of people, a lot of skeptics claim that, you know, the whole Bigfoot thing kind of started in, what was it, 67?
67 with the Gimlin?
Yeah, the Patterson-Gimlin Patty. In 67. And a lot of people believe that just prior to that, of course, people were finding and documenting. And just prior to that, by not more than a few years, I think, was the first penning of the name Bigfoot. And it was in a newspaper. And it was based on the fact that they found these big tracks around this logging camp. And it's also alleged that one of the guys that found them was a big prankster. So people weren't really sure what to think of it. But they did report it on it in the newspaper, and they casted it, I think, as well. But most skeptics say that that's kind of where it started, and then just other people ran with it, and it's just been this long-running joke. But then you find reports from the 1800s, and you find you know, things that predate that by a long period. There's, you know, been, but they used to refer to them as wild men,
right?
You know, the wild man sighting in Missouri and stuff like that. So that was prior to there being a Bigfoot name or people being aware of a native term that we understand as Sasquatch, even though I think that that's actually a bastardization of the actual native term.
Right.
But it was somebody's mistake, so it became Sasquatch. But anyway, let's see what this one is. And it comes out of it's Calaveras County in California near Lake Comanche, Wallace, California, 1948. Excuse me. A little bit froggy. 1970s veteran researcher Mike Dardanos, originally from Los Banos, California, told me about a story he was given in 1968 that occurred in Calaveras County, California, around 1948. The story involved teenagers who were fooling around shooting off their Daisy rifles and Red Ryder BB guns near Lake Comanche in Wallace, California. The six of them were led by a former commercial fisherman named Dixon, and he was an uncle of one of the boys who took them out to teach them proper rifle etiquette. During a break for lunch, the 68-year-old Dixon caught wind of a really foul smell, and at first he thought his thermos had gone rank on him, but smelling again more closely, the coffee was fine. By then, the boys smelled the odor in the air and thought it might be a dead animal, and curious as growing boys are, after lunch, they took off to investigate the smell. Towards the center of the lake on the north side, they found a rotting corpse, but only some parts of it. What was left of it lay sprawled on the bank, with the right half of the pelvis gone. Toning down Dardano's graphic remarks a little, he said, maggots had decimated most of the remaining corpse, and a cloud of black flies were thick over the large foot, which had partially rotten in a puffy white in the water. The left leg and left buttocks were completely covered in black hair, about 1 to 4 inches long, but nothing else was around the area to be found of the rest of the body. They figured what was left of the male genitalia was probably pulled off and eaten by coyotes, and none of them have heard of the abominable snowman, and they thought it was probably a local vagrant who lived in the hills. Dardanos, after hearing the tale of a hair-covered torso, went ahead and made a note of possibly dead Sasquatch found near Lake Comanche and located west of Camp Seco, but south of Comanche Village in Central California around 1948. So apparently they might have found a corpse, but it doesn't sound like there was a whole lot of it left, but the foot and one half of the pelvis and leg, I assume.
That could give you enough.
Right. I mean, it looked like a foot of a human, you know, with the same shape, but it was obviously much bigger. Sorry.
Well, it, you know, and I think it's interesting, you know, but when Bigfoot die, when Sasquatches die, mm-hmm. you know, aren't they usually, well, unless they're by themselves, unless they're a rogue or an outcast, you know, whichever you prefer, but aren't they usually spirited away by other, you know, other of their troop or their tribe and clan, whatever that may be? That's something I've got to get figured out, too. I've got to ask somebody about that. What's right. the proper terminology? Family, whatever that may be. Anyhow, yeah. so that would, to me, with this understanding, that would have been a rogue. But you would think that, well, you would think that somebody would know. One of his other ex-clan would know, you know. But maybe they just don't care. I mean, you're an outcast, you know.
Maybe. Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, and there's a lot of theories going around about what happens to these things when they die. And now there's allegedly a report by a park ranger, and it's apocryphal at best. I haven't ever heard it substantiated, but he alleges that he watched a group of Bigfoot carrying another one mm-hmm. and burying it mm-hmm. and observed from a distance through binoculars the whole burying, you know, quote-unquote ceremony.
Right.
Now, other people are trying to say, and maybe they're right, I don't know, but they've made the claim that when a Bigfoot dies, the rest of the family group will consume it.
Oh, yeah.
And so there isn't anything left,
right.
Including grinding the bones down to powder and, you know, and all of that. So
that is some civilized, shows real civilization to them, though. I mean, to be able
culture,
to.
Culture, anyway. Yeah.
Well, yeah, culture. That's a better way. You know, it because it shows that they're aware enough to get rid of whatever the evidence may be left lying around, you know? And it really speaks to their own kind of spirituality, you know,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing, or at least the way they believe. Let me say that.
Yeah,
so that's interesting.
Lady in the chat said maybe they're bad Bigfoot like bad people, and maybe use the death penalty in all seriousness, and that's possible. And you know, I've heard that claim before, and I know Kat made that claim as well.
Well, we and somebody else said something about that too. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, but that there are some what am I trying to say? Some offenses that they can do. Just very few. But if they do, it's like a death penalty, and one of which is killing their own kind,
right.
and the others, I don't know what they were, and I don't think Kat ever directly told us what it was, but that was the indication, was that there were some things that were just absolutely forbidden.
Unforgivable. Interesting.
And so I don't know if it's always a death penalty or if it's just a... You know, you're on your own.
Banishment,
you don't, which when you're thinking of anything, surviving alone is incredibly tough for any creature living in the wilds.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not easy for human beings either. I mean, you know,
we're not even in the wilds.
Yeah. But when you're thinking of, you know, you need successful hunts, mm-hmm. you can't get injured because if you do, you can't hunt. You may be able to gather, but...
And you don't have anybody to help care for you.
Right. You know? You don't have anybody to watch your back when you're sleeping and stuff like that. And, you know, with the family groups, allegedly with the Bigfoot anyway, and I don't know enough about the Dogman to have any opinion of this, but there's the idea that there are watchers. So there's, you know, they generally sleep during the day and are up nocturnally, but during that daytime period, there are designated watchers who take positions around the family group and watch over them
right.
during their time of rest. And I don't know what they do when it comes nighttime, or if they maybe stay up for more than 24 hours at a time just taking their shift or whatever. But
it's a long freaking shift.
Right. Well, I mean, so do they then sleep at the night while the other ones go out and do their right. thing? I don't know. I would think that they probably, you know, just some of them don't sleep one night and while the others do, and then the next night they'll get to sleep, but some other ones will have to stay awake. You know, maybe it's like that. I don't know.
The graveyard shift.
Right. Yeah. Who drew the short straw?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. You know, and that's an interesting question, though. I mean, because, you know, how, you know, and MCAT said that he wonders about how the family's structured and things like that, you know, as well, you know, and so, you know, somebody has told us, I think it was Cindy, has mentioned rogues before.
Yep.
The ones that have been ostracized or kicked out or banished, sure, or, you know, yeah, you can roll with us, but you got to take care of yourself, you know, whatever that is, that permanent bachelor kind of thing. I don't know.
Right.
But anyhow, and, you know, so, you know, and what are those offenses that get you banished, or why do you become rogue, or do they leave because they don't agree with something that happened with a decision? You know, I mean, is it a political situation? You know, I mean, they've got to have their own politics in a sense, because
it's a tribal thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, it's a lot of questions about them.
And I've heard many, many different variations of that same thing. Like, what does the groups look like? Mm-hmm. And generally what I've heard is that it's usually an alpha male and an alpha female, and then their offspring.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be other, you know, other individuals that are, you know, adult as well with that group. Right. But there's like, there's the chief and the what would the female chief be called? I'm I don't
big
have a
mama. But no, you'd alpha. I think alpha female.
I think
much.
She's called ma'am because you didn't call her anything else. No, but you know, and then I've heard other things where they're talking about groups of, you know, a dozen together that, you know, may not have been a family group, but they're gathered together. So
right.
I don't know. And
well,
again,
I think that would be more of a clan at that point, though.
It would seem, yeah. It would definitely seem so.
Or tribe, clan, tribe, yeah.
Right. So, very strange. And I don't know enough about the dogman / wolf people and how they are organized in all of this. Now, I've heard, with that whole situation, I've heard, you know, variations are that they are, like, in territorial regions alongside of Sasquatch, but they don't really mix. And then I've heard the other thing where they are, you know, tolerant of each other and kind of live around each other. And then I don't know. I know that it seems, in terms of dogmen, it seems that their habitat is really much more closely aligned with waterways.
Right.
And they definitely stay near water at all times, more so than the Bigfoot / Sasquatch. I don't know what it is about their physiology that makes them stay near water, but they seem to travel always around waterways for the dog men and, and, you know, / wolf people. You know, and I don't know if that's true or not, but I know Linda Godfrey has mentioned that. Shell Dion has mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from both of them, I would definitely regard it as probably pretty
good information,
pretty possible at that point. But yeah, Linda, in all of her research, of course, she's very methodical and very, very organized with this. And she made that observation that waterways are always right near wherever dogman sightings are. So then you get into other fringe ones like these, you know, other things like the rake, for instance. And honestly, we just don't know anything about them. Yep. I mean, they're these. And ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't heard of a term like of the rake, they are essentially these, I don't know, spidery thin beings that look like bald people. And they aren't clothed. They're just kind of running around. Now, if you look on the internet, there's lots of famous pictures going around of what the rake is.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like this creepy little thing. It kind of looks like a Smeagol. You know, what is it? Gollum?
Gollum and Smeagol, yeah.
Gollum, Smeagol, different names of the same thing. But it kind of looks like that, except man-sized, but bald and hairless, clothless. But they kind of crawl around the same way in what I've heard of their descriptions. But I got a couple stories of the rake pulled up, and I don't know. Honest to God, I have no idea whether they're at all credible or just creative writing. Because when it comes to the rake, it's so hard to find anything worth mentioning with them or you know, any kind of encounter stories, because the encounters are so incredibly rare. Now, as what Shell was saying about them is that they are these incredibly aggressive, horrible things. And she said that she'd much rather meet a dogman,
right,
way more so than she'd want to meet another rake, because she had an encounter with one. And, you know, if they are absolutely that horrible, and they, and it seems they are, but if they are, I you know, I hope I never do see them. You think about it. So why are there so few sightings? Well, maybe the rake is just that much more lethal and doesn't care. So that anything that sees it,
there's no victims left alive.
Right. And there's no witnesses, because whatever saw it was probably on the menu, you know. And that's a creepy feeling. But you think about the missing 411 stories.
Right.
And, you know, the other missing people in and around cities and in rural areas, you know, they just kind of disappear. And what if it was some of these were the rake? And mm-hmm. that's why there's so few stories, is that mm-hmm. there's nobody left alive to talk about it, you know, or very few.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that could be it or not, but I certainly am curious about it. And it's concerning, but I can't even tell you, honest to God, where they're sighted most. I really know that little about them. But a lot of people believe that the rake is also one of the origins for the legend of the Slender Man. Let's get back into some more of these Squatch reports, because I got tons of them. Now, this should be a good one, actually, because it's a bow hunter story. And a lot of times, bow hunters have the most incredible encounters with these, with the Bigfoots and Sasquatch, because, you know, they're kind of out there and being stealthy.
They're not being, there's no,
There's no big report when they take something down. So it's a very, very stealthy kind of hunting. And, you know, they have to be stealthy and they have to be, you know, quiet. Otherwise, they'll scare the prey away.
Right.
So bow hunters are probably the most skilled hunters out there, in my opinion. But I wrote this almost 25 years ago. I have no idea how many times it's been published since then. And I also have nothing more to add. I make no observations regarding the following. It was as I've written in August 23rd. 1960, and I've been out in my own for 6 months living by competing at rodeos. I was only 16 and had just finished a rodeo in Washington and had a couple hundred in my pocket, and three fellow hands asked me to go out with them on a canoe trip in BC, British Columbia, so to get their winter meat, and they were all BC natives. And he names them. I don't know if I need to do that. But he said, he said they had lots of equipment and knew the area to the north and east of Risky Creek, R-I-S-K-E Creek, and they would launch the freighter canoes 20 foot long with 7.5 or 7.5 Evinrud kickers at a place near Horsley, east of Williams Lake, and go north and east from up there, a string of lakes and rivers. And we took two canoes with 35 gallons of spare gas, spare prop, and 100 shear pins. You got to have shear pins when you're going to have an outboard motor. Oh, man. I can't tell you how many times I popped the shear pin on an outboard in the fishing boat back home. But we had a tent in each canoe and a rifle and shotgun, two fishing rods, one tackle box, bedrolls, and grub box. And we traveled light because we knew there would be portages. And since they were all natives, could shoot anything as we went. The word portage refers to the practice of carrying a canoe or other boat over land to avoid an obstacle on the water route, such as rapids or a waterfall. Excuse me. We had 20 pounds of flour, salt, pepper, tea, lard, pemmican, and tobacco to give to natives we encountered. The word for pemmican is a concentrated mixture of fat and protein used as a nutritious emergency foodstuff. It gives all the history of pemmican.
Wow.
But my friends were about 20 to 23 years old, and I was really the baby. The first 2 days were absolutely uneventful. We made good time and moved steadily up a series of lakes and creeks, and the first night we camped at an abandoned mine of some sort and dined on fresh fish and rice and beans. And day two of the stream got narrower and swifter, and we had two portages, and we made nearly 50 miles. Wow, that's moving. In our canoe, Jim and I, we had the Winchester Model 110 30-06 and my 12-gauge. Model 12 pump, ducks and geese were everywhere, and we had those for dinner. And the next night, fixed with some French name I can't recall, you pick them, rub them with lard and season them. A green branch is bent into a U and inserted in the cavity, and they are suspended over the coals. The best duck I ever ate. Mm. Sounds good. I'm getting hungry while reading this.
I'm fitting to get me some duck.
Yeah. On day three, Kid and Earl, in the lead canoe, rounded a bend and shot a young moose, about 600 pounds, and we spent 4 hours dressing and boning and caching the meat on an elevated platform. It froze every night. And so we were at the base of a small lake as we were working. Three canoes with natives came down the lake at full speed, and Kid waved them in, and there were four adult males and two maybe teenagers and three adult women and one girl of about 10. I assume they were an extended family, and we gave them about 100 pounds of meat and some flour and tea and tobacco.
Dang.
That was really nice. Wow. They spoke no English, at least not in front of me, and I understand not one word, except twice when one of the women said, Sasquatch, and I laughed twice. At the time, I assumed she was making a joke for me. They left after smoking with us and giving us three big white fish and some pemmican. We took maybe 20 pounds of prime meat, caching the rest under the tarp and some bark, and the platform was standard cache for that area, about 12 feet off the ground, and we went on, still heading north and east, and we left the small lake and went through a chute into another lake and then east into a smaller river. This stream was maybe 40 to 60 feet wide and medium swift, and about seven, we started looking for a campsite and found one on the north bank in a bend in the river. The right bank was covered with boulders, round by glaciation and current, but left bank was clear with a flat area under some trees. We were all tired and hit the sack before full dark. It doesn't get dark there until tomorrow. It doesn't get dark there until tomorrow. I don't know what that means. Excuse me. Sometime, maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, Jim and I were awakened by a loud crash in the campsite. Thinking bear, we grabbed our guns and kicked back the tent flap. Nothing. Jim had a flashlight and turned it on, and Earl and Kid were now out in the tent and armed, out of the tent, rather, and a boulder about the size and shape of a bowling ball had just destroyed our Dutch oven and part of our cook box. We stood around trying to sort things out when a second boulder hit Kid and Earl's tent dead center. It came straight down through the trees, and I was standing there open mouth when both Kid and Jim grabbed me and Earl and drug us deeper into the trees. Naturally, there was a lot of discussion, but I won't relate the tenor of that. We spent the rest of the short night in a circle, back to back, safeties off. Mm-hmm. From time to time, we would hear some more rocks hit, and once, just once, some sort of strange hooting from the other side of the river. After good sunup, we slowly crept back to camp, and one tent was toast, as were the cook box and most of the cooking equipment. I counted 9 rocks, ranging from the size of a bowling ball to a beach ball size.
Dang.
Good God, that's heavy. The largest weighing maybe 150 to 200 pounds. Fortunately, the canoes were undamaged, and we quickly pulled up camp and started out. We got to the meat cache that morning, and it was gone. Mm-hmm. Not destroyed, gone. Totally 100% gone. No logs, no rope, no meat, no carcass, and I have no opinion. Mm-hmm. We ran wide open going out and camped that night in the canoes in the middle of a lake. Jim and Kid are now dead, killed in a float plane crash some years ago. Earl, I don't know about. I'm certain of only 5 things regarding that trip. 1, those rocks were not on the bank where we pitched tent. And we pitched camp, it says both times. And they were not carried into our camp. They were thrown.
Wow.
No human being did it. I have no desire to ever again go into that country. And 5, I am not a believer or a skeptic. but I don't exactly discount much if it were, if which I don't understand. And as for the lack of scientific evidence, it is just in recent times that we have learned that Caucasoids lived in North America as long as 12,000 years ago. If our ancestors had not lived in villages with middens, they had roamed in groups of two or three. We might still not know about a Clovis woman or many of them. Something to read?
Yeah, actually, I found that Yowie report from. Please. It's from the Northern Star, which is down in Queensland, I believe, Australia. Yowie attacks Queensland driver. A driver who says a hulking Yowie thumped the bonnet of his truck has been plagued by nightmares and says spotting the creature was the worst experience of his life. The 53-year-old is told of a terrifying encounter with Australia's version of Bigfoot while driving through a bushy part of the Gold Coast hinterland last November. The truckie wants to be identified only as Gary, describing how he was forced to slam on the brakes when the creature emerged from the bush in broad daylight at Witherin. He eyeballed the 3-meter-tall Yowie before it thumped the bonnet of his truck before melting into the dense forest.
What do you mean thumped? Like
thumped on it.
Oh, with his thumped hand? Like, yeah. Bonk. Okay.
Yeah. It was the worst thing that has ever happened to me, he told the bulletin. I tried to push it to the back of my head, and I think that was freaky. It just can't be real. I just couldn't get it out of my mind. I was having trouble sleeping at night. Gary said prior to his encounter, he had never believed in such a creature and was fearful of people's reactions to his story, including what his wife would make of it. In the end, she believed him, he said. It's an unfortunate coincidence that the dash cam on Gary's truck was being serviced that day.
Oh, no.
And he didn't manage to reach for his other camera in time.
Well, yeah.
You know, there's the whole thing right there. So. the last thing for the... Lasting for 5 seconds, you're staring at a monster in the face, watching it make sure that it steps around you. You're scared for your life, not grabbing for your camera. Gary has driven on that road, has only driven on a different road. So he hasn't been on that road since he saw it. He says, I figured it was a 1 in a million thing. Lightning doesn't strike twice. On the other hand, I would like to see it with a camera just to prove it.
Wow.
There you go.
Now, that's the other complaint a lot of people have. Like, oh, there's cameras everywhere. Why aren't people getting pictures? If they're out there, why aren't there better pictures and more of them? It's like, you know, you have to think about the scale of this creature, of this being. Just for Bigfoot, for instance. I mean, you think of 8 feet, you know, and 8 feet, and these things are reported 10 feet and over. But 8 foot is the basically, you know, in a standard home, it's the distance from your floor to your ceiling. Now, you can imagine that being filled up, that space being filled up with the strongest ape-looking thing that's not happy to see you. And it's, you know, it's huge.
Right.
And you don't know at that moment if you're dying or not.
Right.
I mean, that's like one of those moments that, you know, it's a pivotal moment of whether or not you get to live longer. And people have all these ideas about, well, just grab your camera and, you know, get a picture. At that point, you're not thinking about, I want a picture so I can show my friends. You're thinking, am I going to live past this moment?
Right. Yeah.
You know, and what do I do? I mean, you've got to be in such a state of panic and shock.
Right.
How do you process that?
Yeah, no doubt. So. You know, and that's something that, you know, people don't, you know, consider though. But consider this, you know, every creature on the face of the earth has some kind of defense mechanism or, you know, way to discourage, you know, attacks, you know, squirrels. Do you know how squirrels and mongooses confront snakes and things like that?
Yeah.
What they do is they stick their tail up in the air, right? And they wave it as fast as they can because it makes their body signature look bigger than it actually is to a snake. And that's how mongoose do it too. They'll get that tail up there and they'll shake it and it'll create in the vision of the serpent or the snake, it'll make it think it's bigger than it actually is. So my point is with Bigfoot, maybe they have a pheromone that they can excrete that causes either fight or flight.
Well, I mean, there's the infrasound, of course.
Infrasound, I was about to say that, yeah. Where you become stunned or, you know, it may go the other way. But I mean, so when you're saying that, you know, they should have grabbed their camera, you know, you don't know what's being deployed against them naturally from right. these things. Right. You know, I mean, me, I'd be just scraping my underwear if I get through it. You know, I may not have underwear when I get through it, you know, but, you know, because, you know, so you can't really blame people for that because unless you've experienced it, you don't know what kind of a state of mind you're in. You don't know what they're, you know, I mean, they're going to feel.
It's a moment when for most of the people that encounter it, it's a moment when something that could not ever exist just stepped into being and it's pissed.
It's not supposed to be here.
You know, it's like it's pissed and it's huge. And you know in that there is nothing you can do except sit there and wonder if you're going to die screaming or if you're going to die crying or what are you going right. to do? That's about the only choice you have.
Squish him into jelly.
And it's not a time of rational thought. It's not like, ooh, I got to get a picture and show everybody. It's like, you know, if it's far away, then you can try, you know.
Right.
But if it's right up and close and personal. And the other problem is that they're usually never alone. You might see one, but there's three other ones that are around you. And they're, you know, they're ready to spring into action if they need to. So, yeah, it's a situation that it would be real easy for a lot of people
right.
with no understanding of what that must be like
right.
to be critical.
Well, you know, and like, even when we had Bear on the show, he talked about taking that film crew out there. And they said the only thing that they could film was the ground.
Right. And it ran right in front of them.
Yeah, ran right in front of them. And I wonder why that is. Because they saw something that's not supposed to be there.
They were, yeah.
And rational thought went right out the window.
And this is a film crew.
Yeah.
That's what their one job was. That's,
you had
that's
one
the
job.
You had one job. And they filmed ground. You know? That's all they filmed. So, I mean, it's just... It's an unrealistic expectation for 99% of the people to have any other response than I'm going to die and how am I going to die?
Right, right.
You know, how much is this going to hurt? You know, that's about it. So really, really easy for people to be critical of that. Now, there's one more out of British Columbia that I was going to read, and this one's a short one. And it says, the home of Harrison Sasquatch is reported to be in Mystery Valley in caves back of 20 Mile Bay, which stretches as far as the Chehalis Lake with Lake Margaret in between. This is in British Columbia, Canada. In 1935, so the story goes, two hairy giants came leaping down the jagged, rocky hillside of Morris Valley and strode across the duck feeding grounds with the agility of mountain goats. The giants walked with an easy gait across the swampy flats at the Morris Creek, straddled a floating log, which they propelled with their hands and huge feet across the stream to the opposite side. Mr. Gustav Tifting, I guess T-Y-F-T-I-N-G, of Agassiz, saw the footprints of a big hairy man sighted earlier along with several others, which were followed across the garden and into the woods beyond where they lost the tracks. The footprints were 16 inches long, 8 inches across the ball of the foot, and 4 inches across the heel.
Oh my.
5 toes and no claw marks. The distance between the footprints was at least 4 feet between toe and heel.
Wow.
That's a huge stride. And all across the potato patch, about 2 inches deep into the wet ground, and they were the shape of a human foot. two prospectors returned to Harrison Hot Springs in June 1957 from a trip into the wilds of Harrison Mountains and told of sighting a huge creature on Spoozum Glacier, 30 to 35 miles northeast of Harrison, and it had quite a human appearance, and so the story go. Mm-hmm. So the stories go. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
That's incredible. That's incredible. That's he pays a lot for his shoes. Well, 8 feet across the and four across the heel.
Yeah,
eight that's across. That's insane.
Yeah, that's a big wide foot. But the key point in there, I think, is just the talk of how they traverse this rocky cliff mm-hmm. like a mountain goat. Like a mountain goat,
yeah.
And if you've ever watched a mountain goat go up those cliff sides. It is. It's just like, oh my God, how is it not falling? It's got these little pegs that it's doing it on, but they just run up and down those things like nothing. And to know that this big, huge, hairy thing that has superhuman strength and superhuman agility also can scale impossible terrain like that with no problem. I mean, the most normal things you would think is, I want to get high. I want to get high off the ground.
Please qualify that.
I want to feel nothing. No. I mean, like, you want to get off the ground. You want to get to an elevated position because there's something big that wants to kill you. Well, they can climb it so much better than you can.
They'll get there. They'll get there up before you do.
Well, they'll get up there and, throw you down probably. So you just got farther to fall. I don't know. That's just one of those things. That's why I say that if indeed they wanted to hurt us, we would be absolutely helpless.
Yep.
To stop it. Mm-hmm. We couldn't, you can't really reason with it. You can't really, outmaneuver it.
Right.
You can't outrun it. You can't outclimb it. You can't outswim it. I mean, these things are going to get you if they want to. But now the amazing thing is that they obviously don't want to, because otherwise we wouldn't have this many stories of people seeing them.
Right. Right.
And be like, oh, there's people. Let's go get rid of the witnesses.
No doubt.
And it would just be a walk in the park for them.
Right.
But.
No, I just found this. It's supposedly a 13-year-old mythical beast filmed in Canadian wilderness.
Huh.
And it says, 13-year-old. Why does this look like it's maybe it was first? What's this?
The beast is 13 years old, or what do you mean?
Well, the 13-year-old mythical beast, I think it's the story's 13-year-old. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it says, was an unknown humanoid creature spotted stalking a moose somewhere in Quebec on a or is this a shaky video, another poor quality internet hoax? That's what I meant.
Internet hoax.
What appears as a 6-foot faceless, hitherto unrecorded human-like creature was filmed stalking a moose, and sensationalist publications are claiming the video has sparked worldwide panic as the identity of the beast baffles millions of viewers after going viral on the internet. Filmed by a local resident, the beast appears to be lurking behind a feeding moose in an isolated Canadian wilderness, and this classically badly focused video shows a faint, pale, human-sized figure moving behind the moose. Wow. Many viewers have speculated that it appears to walk on its hind legs like a human, and could it be the legendary rake monster?
Oh,
comparable to Bigfoot and Yeti, according to the Express. Sightings of the Canadian rake. The legendary rake was described as a brutal, savage humanoid creature with canine characteristics, although it has never savaged any human, never mind brutally. Many claiming it attacks without provocation is using its long, blade-like fingers to pull its victims apart.
Oh.
Oh, and there you go. That's the end of that. It goes, oh, wait, no.
There's more. There's more.
The video has been viewed more than 102,000 times, which is probably, that's not viral, but I'm sure it's got more than that now. And social media viewers have provided a host of possible explanations for the sighting, responding to the filmmaker's question, looking at the video, I saw a strange shape at the back left. Can someone tell me what it is? In response, one commenter wrote, that looks like the rake type character stalking the moose. But skeptics, however, claimed that the footage was misleading and suggested that the creature was no more than a speck on the car window. But this does not argue why the creature apparently moves in the footage. It's a speck of reality. In my 20s, I studied photography and video communications at the college. Since I've conducted numerous photography exhibitions and have filmed hundreds of hours of documentary video footage. On many occasions, I've discovered my own rake monsters in that such appearances are caused by well understood occurrences which photographers know about. A tiny speck of dust on the lens can sometimes appear to take on monster proportions, and what it is. A tiny speck of dust can.
Okay.
Lens can appear in monster proportions because they are sometimes so close to the lens, moving the camera as much as a few millimeters causes the speck to appear to move several feet on video footage. A good way to recreate the effect is to hold your finger up against your nose in your living room. Now close one eye and look at the finger. Mm. So he's saying, sure. You know, spot your fingertip. It's the way you find out which dominant eye you have.
Mm-hmm.
Now close one eye and look at the finger. When your finger moves a few millimeters, notice how it covers and reveals what appears to be several feet against the wall. The effect is also apparent when the So basically, this guy's saying it could be a speck. But we've talked about it before, you know, a swinging cobweb near the lens of the camera causes a motion movement, you know, that may look like it's only a millimeter or two, but it's actually, when it's seen, it looks like it's moving a good ways, a few feet or so. So that was him possibly trying to debunk this. But the description of the creature was just amazing. Let me get back up to there. Classically bad. Okay. Pale human sized figure moving behind the moose.
Hmm.
Now a moose can be huge depending on how old they are. You know, I've seen 9 foot at the top, you know, the top of the head moose.
Wow.
They're huge. But you know, they're big enough that you have a scale. You could honestly say, you know, well, that's human size compared to whatever it may be. You know, it would be reasonable to make that assumption.
Sure.
It appears to walk on hind legs like a human. So interesting. And that was up in Quebec.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.